Welcome to Holden Village. Bruce Eklund will be leading a discussion on secret shame, child sexual abuse. So let's listen in on Bruce.
My job is a supervisor at Snohomish County Juvenile Court in Everett, Washington. It's a county just north of Seattle. We're the third largest county in Washington. The population of the county is a little under 600,000. Grown substantially in the 20 years that I've been there, going from primarily an urban or a rural county to now having pretty substantial urban kinds of problems. In that capacity, I basically have two different roles. One is I supervise a program that deals with juvenile offenders, where we try and keep the offenders in the community rather than institutionalizing them. And one of the groups of those offenders are the juvenile sexual offenders within Snohomish County. We have a community-based
treatment program for them, which at the end of today's session I'll talk about a little bit. The other part that I supervise is a program called the Volunteer Guardian Ad Litem Program, or in some areas it's called the CASA program, court-appointed special advocates. And these are volunteers who are trained to advocate the best interest of the child in child abuse cases where the parents are being brought to court for child abuse and neglect. And roughly 35% to 40% of the cases that guardians are appointed on are sexual abuse cases. My goal in today's sessions is basically to break the session into kind of two parts. One is to present some information to you about some of the things that we know in the field, some of the research tells us and some of the clinical information tells us about the nature and extent of child sexual abuse. And then spend the rest of the session in terms of opening it up to conversation. So I hope to take about 30 minutes to quickly go through some of these things. There's no way in an hour that you can cover a session this complex with as many sides as there are. So as I go through the material, if there's things that kind of spark something in your mind or something you don't understand, because I'm going to move fairly quickly and make some huge jumps of assumptions in terms of information. It's a very difficult area to understand. It's an area that, as far as the research goes, it was the late 70s when essentially the first research started coming out about child sexual abuse. That information kind of parallels the women's movement, and in particular the issues of victimization that have come out of that, the rape issues, and understanding the victimization issues and the power issues. So there's it's a parallel kind of track that has gone with that. And those of us who work substantially with the children are very grateful for the women's movement in terms of bringing to light the issues of victimization that otherwise were not at least widely known and talked about. There's some things about sexual abuse that really drive a passion in me. And I think that it is because it's such an anathema and the opposite of everything that I believe in terms of raising healthy children. It interferes with and disturbs that natural progression of people emerging into their sexuality. The developmental aspect of sexuality is a real powerful part of who we are as people. One of the things that sexual abuse does is makes that process more difficult. Elmer Witt in the Bible study talks about spirituality and sexuality as kind of being the opposite sides of the same coin that helps define who we are. And so in a sense, you're taking a significant part of who we are and subjecting it to damage and potentially to lifelong damage. And so what at the very least what it does is that it means that people have to provide significantly extra energy to repair. Okay. Kind of the way I'd like to structure there's several key writers that have helped us understand kind of the structure. One of them is Dr. Roland Summit, who is from UCLA. He's a pediatrician in UCLA, and he wrote an article back in 1983 called the Child Sexual Abuse Accommodation Syndrome. That was a powerful work that basically helps us understand some of the key structure of what goes on in the dynamics of sexual abuse. Another important person in the reporting of sexual abuse issues is a man by the name of David Finkelhor, who has done work in kind of studying, again, he's the one that comes up with a model of understanding it. A four-traumagenic model is what he calls, four sources of trauma that occurs out of sexual abuse. He's also done substantial looking at what is the motivating factor of sexual offenders. And that piece is outside of what we're going to be talking about, but there is some good literature dealing with that. I think a way of understanding the issues. First, understanding the basic vulnerability of children, the dependency that children have on the adults around them, and this isn't just parents, but there's a sense of that people who are older and bigger than children have inherent power over children, and it's not and it's power that is almost assumed by children. Some of it is out of fear, some of it is out of respect, some of it is out of modeling or wanting to be like or wanting to be bigger. And so therefore when they're around someone who's bigger, there's an intensely strong draw to model and to wanting to be liked and wanting to be a part of that older person's life. And so and that's a fundamental part of children's survival. So as children grow, that sense of connectedness with the adults around them is part of it's an instinctual kind of thing that's part of what helps them be healthy. And it's this part of the child, this vulnerable part of the child, then that the sex offender approaches and uses as a means of having access to the child, the particular vulnerability of the children for those that are older and bigger. The way that the offender does that is essentially through a sense of secrecy and playing on the helplessness of the child and creating situations for the helplessness. And to a certain extent, these two parts, as Dr. Summit talks about them, are fairly closely related. What secrecy does is that it creates both a sense of safety for the child, as well as a fear. It puts those two things kind of together. That by being secret, this is something that is our special secret, or don't tell anybody, don't tell your parents. Or if it is the parent who's offending, you know, don't tell your mother, because this is our special secret, okay? Doesn't have to, usually initially you don't have to, for a child, explain why. There's enough power in just that sense of secrecy to gain compliance. So that sense of secrecy is both that sense of safety. If I'm quiet, it lays the burden upon the child. If I'm quiet, then I'll be safe. So it's no wonder then that an estimated two-thirds of the actual sexual abuse that happens is never reported. In 1992, there were 72,000 cases of child sexual abuse nationwide which were reported. Okay, an estimated, based upon the other statistics in terms of the number of actual cases, and again, these are these are studies that are difficult to verify, but somewhere between 210 and 300,000 in a year is how many sexual abuse incidents or victims there actually are. So that's part of the dilemma and part of the drive of why that happens, why it's most cases of sexual abuse never come out. Many, many adults are dealing with sexual abuse issues as adults and struggle with marriages, struggle with intimacy, struggle with sexuality, struggle with belief and a sense of trust and becoming vulnerable, which are all part of having healthy relationships as we get into adults. People really struggle with that because of sexual abuse incidents. So that sense of secrecy, which creates that sense of shame, okay, the secret shame that's a powerful drive, and you link that with then, we all know the power of sexuality within us. It's built within us. It's part of that, the piece of us, if you look at it just purely animalistically, it's the continuation of the species draws out of that the power essentially of the sexuality within us. The sense of helplessness then is more related to that, to the relationship issue, the two parts of the abuse, two sides of the abuse of sexual abuse. One is relationship and power, the other is sexual in nature. So you're using the sense of relationship or this implied power that all people bigger than or older than a child have, and it creates this kind of helplessness. I have no ability to respond to this. I don't have the power to be able to stand up to this person and say no. So it's one of the dilemmas that we have in developing our personal safety curriculums, and one of the pieces of that almost always is say no like you really mean it. But that doesn't work for a kid who the very person that he's supposed to say yes to, that he's supposed to be able to trust, is the one that's abusing him or her. Incidentally, to clarify a picture, 85% of the offenders are men. Okay, so this is a male issue in our culture, and we can talk. That's not specifically part, but there are some reasons for that, and we can talk about that later if that's something that's brought up. The other thing is that there are about 70% of the victims are girls. The known victims, the ones who report, somewhere between 70 and 80% are girls. There's some other issues there in terms of why that is. Some of the researchers basically say that there's probably a lot more boys that are victims, but boys don't tend to come forward. There's a lesser permission for boys to declare themselves victims than there are for girls to declare themselves victims. And that may be changing. There may be part of the merging of the of understanding our roles and increasing the awareness of nurture on men and boys is part of the thing that will help turn some of that so that there's a greater acceptance of the need for men to be vulnerable. It's a long time coming. It's a process, but that's one of the things that may shift the balance there. What comes out of this sense of helplessness then is a sense of being trapped, backed into a corner, not having the options. A thing that builds within that sense of entrapment is what I call the seamless continuum of sexual abuse. In that there's no clear place where the abuse started, because it usually starts within relationship. If it's a parent, it usually starts with a means of gaining access or gaining the child's trust, which may already be there, but then gaining access to having the child by themselves and beginning with games that may not be sexual at all, but getting to, you know, having the child, having fun with the child with the intent that at some point in time there's sexual activity that starts, but the child can't perceive when that is, so that as the type of act, as the sexual abuse increases, as it increases here, the child looks back and can't see a point where it's, you know, this is when it started. Two parts of the seamless continuum that are real important. One is that the child always feels complicit because they gather the feelings that are here, which they were having fun with, and that was, this is a person that they know, love, and trust, or that they enjoy being with. And so the process of being with that person, it may not be sexual back here, but they carry with them the good feelings within the relationship here, so that it moves into things, you draw on those feelings, the offender draws on those feelings, so that then the victim can't look back, and or when the victim looks back and says, well, I've been a part of this as much as he has. And so there's that sense of guilt when they finally up here begin to feel that it's bad. It's difficult to break through that sense of their own guilt. Kids have a sense of being complicit anyway. I mean, it's real easy as parents to get them to kind of feel guilty. But and the other thing is that they have this sense that parents are all seeing, and parents somehow intuitively know what's going on, even though they really don't. And so they have that sense that, well, if my parents don't break it up, or if my parent is doing this to me, it therefore, by definition, must be okay. So that seamless continuum, this plays significant havoc in our legal system. Because one of the goals within the legal system, and we'll talk about this more tomorrow, is to define a specific incident that happened at a specific time. And that's what the legal system has to determine in order to get a conviction. Okay, so you can see then where the child is going to have a hard time. Some, and children also don't remember chronologically, they remember experientially. So they remember the things by things that happened around them and by the emotional impact that it had on them. So they may remember something back here a lot more than they remember something here. Whereas to adult minds, the thing that happened here is far more grievous. So that getting judges and juries and all of that sort of thing to understand that aspect of children has been a struggle. There.
Yeah, some of the courts are trying to use a term now. It's called cumulative harm.
Yeah.
Versus imminent danger.
That's that continuum.
Yeah.
That's that increasing. That's good.
Because some lawyers who are on the side of the predator will say, well, show us a time it really happened. That's right. Imminent danger. And the judge would come back and say, well, we're looking at cumulative effect, cumulative harm. And it's just what you're saying. It started out innocently, and at no point could we say it was a direct act. But it's cumulative harm, and that's what I'm hoping to hear from.
That's good. That's good. Thank you. There's another part that we'll talk about later when we deal with the concept of accommodation that also plays havoc within the legal system. So the issue then is you have this vulnerable child, he's essentially trapped or tricked into sexual acts, is ultimately you could almost use that as a definition of child sexual abuse. The entrapment that comes is that sense of not having any alternatives, and the accommodation part is where when a person who's vulnerable and they're trapped and they don't have anywhere to go, that their sense of what they need to do, the kind of automatic response then, is to accommodate to the wishes or the desires of this more powerful person who they're in contact with. So that sense of accommodation is a powerful piece here, in that you link that also with the fact, particularly in incest situations, where you have this person is the person who is supposed to be caring for and has control over the child's residence, their clothes, money to buy things, their food. This is the person who's in charge of all of that. And so the child really doesn't have any choice, but that the appropriate response, part of that development of children as they grow, is to learn to accommodate. They learn about the world, that's their exploring, okay? And once they get up into, so like age 4 and 5, and they get off into school, that's why we set first time of going to school at that point. It's not arbitrary. It becomes part of their job then to take this information that they have and to begin to learn how to live within it. And to a certain extent, that's the definition of accommodation. This is the hand I've been dealt, and this is then, these are the things that I have to do in order to exist and survive within that. And so what happens then with this accommodation is children actually initiate the sexual involvement with their offending parents. They will initiate sexual activity because they know that's what's expected of them, and they know it will please the parent. Okay. Think of how that plays havoc within our legal system. So if you don't take that in the context of the overwhelming power that this person has over them, if you don't take into account the fact that this is a person that the child has to get along with, then that sounds like it's the child's fault. And one of the key pieces that culturally we keep falling off the edge on is that somehow the child should have been able to protect themselves. Somehow, this is such a dastardly deed, something that we can barely comprehend why someone would do this, that we keep looking for ways to kind of get back and saying, oh, the child must have had something to do with this. And so it keeps pushing us, that sense of accommodation that ultimately is part of the child's development, you know, pushes us back a way that we ought not to go. Then what happens is there's always some form of disclosure. There's always some form of disclosure. Part of the reason for that is that it's normal for children to have to learn to process. Part of their games, part of the questions that they ask parents have to do with learning about what their world is. Well, if their world includes the sexual activity and the power kinds of things, what they say to their parents and how they talk about issues is part of what happens. But it usually comes out in ways that is certainly not clear, and usually very mixed in with other kinds of normal statements. And so if perhaps an uncle is abusing a child, the child would say, I don't like Uncle Bill. And that's their disclosure, okay? Children believe that parents know everything, okay? And so then if, as a parent, if we're busy washing the dishes or mowing the lawn, or when the child tells us that, and we say, oh, you know, we have a different perspective of Uncle Bill, right? Because there's a secret. Uncle Bill has a secret that we don't know about. So we don't have that information to be able to respond. And so our relationship with Uncle Bill is real different than the child's relationship to Uncle Bill. But what we tend to do as adults then is to explain, yeah, Uncle Bill sometimes can be kind of strange, but he's good at heart. You know, so we'll essentially, unknowingly, often as parents, kind of deny the attempt at disclosure or to try and figure the world out. Well, actually, the child is getting a valuable piece of information for them, and that's that. Well, what's happening must be okay. So inadvertently, and oftentimes it has to do and it's process. Children are process oriented. They're emotional, and so that as this thing comes up, they're probably going to ask several times about different things to confirm it. But again, that sense that the delayed, conflicting, and unconvincing disclosure, it does occur around these things. It's different if the offender is outside the family than if the offender is in the family. The problem of understanding and coming to grips with, is it safe to talk about this because of the power of the secrecy, is much more powerful if it's within the family, because the relationship of that person is much more powerful by definition. And the fear of, usually one of the things that's said by the offender to kind of hold on to that secrecy is if you tell, it'll break up the family, I'll go to jail and you'll go to foster care. Okay. And the child believes it because they don't have any alternative to not believe it. And what it does is that it places the burden on the child of holding the family together. It's a role reversal, a powerful role reversal. And suddenly this child has in their hands the ability to tear this family apart. And what a fearful thing that is for the child. So the child takes that into their heart, and you see these children. And we see these children in schools, and they suddenly become adults. They suddenly aren't spontaneous anymore. they suddenly sit back and don't participate. They withdraw because of the fear of giving the secret. And it's a precious thing that they have to keep. Suddenly, I'm in control as to whether my family stays together. So that's a powerful thing that comes out of the incest situation. A book that any of you who were here last week, Judy Matson, wrote this book under a pseudonym of Martha Jansen. And it has now reached a point where she is declaring that this is her book, but she wrote this. She was a child victim of incest. It is singularly the most powerful book I've ever read on the issue of understanding that power, and from a child's perspective, to be able to understand the shame that goes with it, and the growth through that shame, and the problems as an adult that resulted from that, the stigma and the sexualization as a child. But it does something that not very many other books that I've ever read does, is that it takes you into the healing, into the therapy process, and moves you into the healing process. And it's an insight into one, the power of sexual abuse over a child, and the effect that it has on that instantaneous power that the child is given, power over keeping the family together. And so immediately there's these two things in the child's life of the fear of abandonment, the fear of annihilation if my family, which is what defines me, suddenly explodes and isn't there anymore. And I have the key, I have the button that I can push to make that happen. And so if you understand the power essentials of that, you can understand why two-thirds of the cases never get reported. And it's amazing to me that a third of them do get reported. Yes?
Well, what typically happens then to the child psychologically if Uncle Bill or Daddy is sent off to prison and the family does in fact fall apart to some degree and the child can justifiably feel responsible?
It leads into the next point. Absolutely. It's a direct line to that. Retraction. We used to say, if retraction occurs, what are we going to do? And now we say, when retraction occurs, what is our plan? Because almost without exception, particularly in family abuse situations, that's exactly what happens. The child thinks back, oh my God, this is what that person said, this is what my dad said was going to happen. And now I've blown it. What is the child going to think then at that stage? What are any of us going to think? What are we going to try and do?
Say it didn't really happen.
Oh, yeah. Try and fix it. And the closest way of trying to fix it is say, yeah, I lied about it. Yeah, I was really angry at my dad, so I just said this to get even with him. Okay? Powerful, driven kind of thing. And again, there's another piece that plays havoc in that. The defense attorneys for offenders really play up on, really build on that. And we have a hard time overcoming and getting the judge and setting that in a context that makes sense.
Do offenders routinely deny that this ever happened? Is that pretty common?
Yeah, pretty much. There's a dynamic that we're beginning to make some inroads in, primarily because of looking at differences in consequences, that the only way offenders can get into community treatment and avoid prison is by admitting it. Okay, so you tend to have more because of that, but until they reach a point where they're facing that decision, very few of them admit it. I'd say less than 5% have. Is there admission on the part of the offender prior to some form of coerced admission? So when the evidence is overwhelming, then they say, yeah. But what it forces, an interesting relationship dynamic in the especially incest situations, is it forces decision like that, and all of a sudden their world is destroyed, okay? So that all of a sudden they're forced with making decisions between their child and their spouse. And most of the instant, there's some history to this. Usually disclosure comes after extensive problems with the child. The problem's already showing, mental health issues, running away, substance abuse, dropping out of school, running with problem kids. So they've already had some parenting problems with this kid. So at the very time that the parent, the non-offending parent, needs to believe the child is most unbelievable. So most cases, the non-offending parent. The other thing about families where sexual abuse occurs, there's a dynamic, and this isn't predictive, but it certainly is a powerful part of research that declares the nature of families where abuse occurs is a hierarchical relationship. So the woman is in a subjective and dependent role within that family. And so therefore, when the abuse comes to light, boy, all those dependency issues come into play. And the likelihood of her own fear of being being left out in the cold is a powerful derivative in terms of getting her to choose for the offender. And the fact that the retraction occurs, see, it didn't really happen, whew, I don't have to deal with this. Those kinds of issues. And so that, that sense of one of the goals of therapy with the non-offending spouse is empowerment, is getting them up there. Sexual abuse within families does not occur where you have an egalitarian relationship between the between spouses.
Really?
I know of no cases in the 15 years that I've been doing this where there was there's been an egalitarian relationship. It's always a hierarchical kind of relationship.
The two the offenders that I've worked with, if it's an adult offender, they usually say, "I was only kidding around." You asked if they admitted it.
You bet.
And if it's a child, the child would just say, "We were just playing." And it's always no big deal. So that's how they kind of escape the direct responsibility of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Is it real common that the situation gets to a point where the child who has been victimized has to be in a courtroom situation where there's a defense attorney grilling them, saying it really wasn't, you know, it really wasn't that bad, was it? Or, you know, are you lying about this and stuff like that? I mean, are they in a situation where they are the ones sitting there and then there's this big adult like nailing for the wall?
In the state of Washington, there's a child victim bill of rights that was passed that allows the child to have with them and even to sit on the lap of a support person, a parent or another person of their choice. So the legal system, in order to get a conviction, the part of the rights of the offender is to face their accuser. That's a fundamental tenet within our legal system. And if that victim is the child, yes, the child does need to testify. There are some exceptions to that. There's a child hearsay exception to testimony, and that allows for professionals to testify if there's been what's called an excited utterance on the part of the child to that adult, that they can testify to that excited utterance, and you can get convictions based upon that. But yeah, most, you need at least some form of corroboration in order to get a conviction. It's a soft process in a sense that in most instances, a lot of the reason that you don't get conviction in sexual abuse cases is you have a three-year-old against an adult, you know, and anything younger than a three-year-old, you absolutely have no ability. Most 3- and 4-year-olds, a lot of 3- and 4-year-olds don't have the ability, just because developmentally they're not ready to be able to take on that kind of thing. So there's a lot of cases that don't get to court because of that, and so there's a lot of offenders that don't get convicted at that point. Prosecutors have developed some very good, you know, the cumulative harm issue is one way of looking at that. But yeah, that's a good question. In our system is not child friendly. It's not user friendly in that. It's not victim friendly. It allows for, you know, some judges are better than others. And we have a couple of judges that that we will not, we actually will not take dependency cases. They will affidavit a judge, and that's a big step for the state AG's office to say we won't take a sex abuse case against this judge, primarily for that reason, that they will not protect their that defense attorneys have field days on victims. And it has to be the judge. The AG can object if the judge does not protect the child in that situation. The AG can't do anything about it. Attorney General. That's who represents the state in see, there's two places that the child could go to court. One is the dependency system, where if it was the parent or the parent did not protect the child, the parents can be taken before the dependency court on the issue of abuse. And then there's the criminal court, which is a different, whole different arena. So you have those two, and the AG represents the state in the dependency, the prosecutor represents in the so it would be the prosecutor if it was a criminal case rather than the AG.
Bruce, can I just make a comment?
Yes.
I agree. At the point of disclosure, that's when things really fall apart, and usually the child's worst fears are manifested, that the father is taken out, or the boyfriend is taken out, and the mother is felt hopeless and helpless, and that's where the retraction occurs. The difference, though, in response to your question, though, if there is a disclosure, remember we got the betrayal initially, mm-hmm. while the abuse was going on. This is therapeutically a very important point, that if a child discloses, and if the parent or parents of the child rush in there and believe and support, that it can almost in a way undo some of that. It's not over, but it's a very therapeutically important point. The opposite that normally occurs, that you outline very well, is that it doubles the betrayal.
Right.
Mother doesn't believe, and therefore the kid retracts, and then I've been betrayed again, and what the hell, I'll just go on that very way. But the opposite that does occur is a very, very important point in healing.
And I think another part of that piece is that in dealing with offenders where it's an incest type of situation, the greatest anger on the victim, the adult survivor of abuse, is most often addressed towards the mother, than the offender, and part of that reason in terms of not having the support there, and that's a phenomenon that kind of is a fairly strong reoccurring theme in dealing with the offense behaviors. Let me touch on a couple. Yes.
Define excited utterance.
Excited utterance is a statement that the child makes without any kind of preliminary or prompting by the professional. In other words, it doesn't come in response to a question. They come running in and they may say, "Mommy, Mommy, Billy put his penis in my mouth." Okay? So if the child is three and the parent takes steps to document that statement, that parent can testify to that statement. Otherwise, you can't testify to hearsay. I can't say that Larry said this in a court of law. Larry has to be brought in to say, "I said this." Okay. So the excited utterance allows the adult then to testify to what and the law allows that as a hearsay exception to the rules of evidence in the legal system. And it allows for conviction based upon that three-year-old coming in and not saying, "Oh, I don't remember. I mean, I blah 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 blah." If the child doesn't qualify because doesn't understand right and wrong, the parent can still testify, or the adult who heard that can still testify, and you can get a conviction based upon that. Quickly, a couple of things in terms of looking at the child and the impact on the child, and I think this is real important, at least for me, in terms of understanding the healing process that goes on. In order to understand the healing process, we have to understand where does the hurt come, where is it hurt, and with sexual abuse, David Finkelhor identifies four sources of that trauma, and I think he's pretty accurate. One is the stigmatization, which has to do with that sense of secrecy. It immediately puts it into a concept of bad, and it lays it into over here where the victim is seen as an object, and that object is essentially lacking in any human value, and that the child then feels the stigma of being valueless. A powerful influence then on the child's sense of even ability to talk about it. If I don't have value, then this is something that's okay to happen to me. So that sense of stigmatization, I'm damaged goods, we get that, it kind of almost absorb that in our culture from television and that sort of thing, that the message that it's kind of like a double standard in terms of it comes across in the churches through the concept of virginity and, you know, saving yourself for sex for when you're in college. Well, if you're victimized, you kind of hang on to that and say, well, I must be, I'll be no good now because this has happened to me. And so that stigmatization is a powerful piece, and the health that can be returned comes within other relationships. It comes within being valued. And that's again where the power of the response of the parent in terms of mitigating that sense of stigmatization, the power of the belief of I told, I'm believed, I'm protected, increases then that you know, it helps to plug some of that that sense of value. It's not over, but it's a strong component on the way to healing. Yes?
Do you think most children are aware immediately that this is a wrong thing?
No.
I work with a lot of neglected and abused kids, and half the battle is showing them that that's not normal.
No. Right.
To be treated like that.
No, and one of the reasons for that, we talked about in an earlier session, my view of it is it's the child's view of the world is determined by the parents. They're the lens through which the child sees the world. If they, as the parent, are abusing the child, that's the view of the world that the child sees, and they see it as this is the way the world is. So no, they don't see it. There isn't anything automatic. The other part is that there's portions of sexual abuse that are pleasurable to the child. That sense of sexuality exists within children too. The pleasure of the touch, the mystery. It comes too soon. They don't understand it. But there is that sense, and sometimes that builds into the sense of guilt as well. And it also, part of the stigmatization is linking that sense of sexuality with feeling with badness, with the environment of that sexuality comes out in a time when there's that secret and that old kind of overall sense of manipulation, and they don't feel good about it, but it feels good to them. So there's that kind of a dilemma that they face. Second of all, it's the sexualization. And to a certain extent, it speaks for itself, and we've already talked about that. They're not ready for this part of them to be developed yet. They don't have the ability to understand it. They don't have the emotional capacity for it. They don't understand it in the context of a relationship and a mutual giving. They don't have enough knowledge about sex to be able to understand the consequence of their action. One of the things that sex offenders always say is that they wanted it. There's always, the offender is always trying to divert the blame to the child. And that my little two-year-old would run around in her diaper all the time, and she was just taunting me. You know, somehow there's this misinformation in the head of the offender that somehow it's a concept of personalizing. You know, someone walks down the street in a bikini and they're doing it just for me. You know, there's that sense of personalizing things that gives them the excuse to do what they need to do or what they feel they need or want to do. So they're always looking for that. The other thing that's an important part of understanding is part of this seamless continuum, and that most offenders will say, well, this is a one-time incident, it's not going to happen again. That's an excuse, because it's not founded in fact. In most instances, it's a history of abuse, and it may not be the actual thing that they did. It may have been the first time they did that, But that sense of increasing sexualization and objectification of victims, of trying to make sex into a power issue, of talking people about it, of using pornography, there's this, it's not something that happens, boom, all of a sudden. All of a sudden I lost control. I'd been drinking, I suddenly lost control of myself, and I was lonely, and I just did this. Okay, it's a longer history than that. Most incidents of sexual abuse, when they come about, or the average length of time that the abuse had been going on back in 1983 at a study at Luther Child Center in Everett, was 2.5 years. That the actual sexual contact had been going on before some form of disclosure had happened. Okay, that length of time has shortened. Research now shows it to be about 1.5 years. And most of us who look at that and kind of try and figure out why, the most common reason that's given is that there's greater ability of permission of children to talk about it. The personal safety curriculums, we like to believe that they're more effective, and that people are, or children are being more empowered to talk about this and to get away to a safe place and to tell someone until you get your help. Those are kind of the three tenets of most personal safety curriculums. Say no like you really mean it, get away to a safe place, and tell someone until you get some help. But that sense of, back to this, the thing that prevents children from doing that is that sense of powerlessness. That they're placed into. It's the relationships, the power. They get placed, and there's a lifelong effect of that. If somehow there isn't a way of re-empowering the child, because then they fall into continuing victimization patterns. And once that invasion happens, they need help to be able to kind of close the floodgates. So it's a key piece in terms of diminishing the trauma, is diminishing that sense of powerlessness, is re-empowering them to be able to have control once again, and know ways of being able to avert it, learn skills. Sense of betrayal, deep down fear then of becoming vulnerable again and trusting someone. And again, that's a piece that as we grow to adults, that and as we move into marriages or committed relationships, we have to have an ability to make ourselves vulnerable to another person. Because the way that successful relationships work is through essentially the opening up of ourselves from that vulnerable point to be able to get connected. The sense of intimacy comes with that. Some multipliers or mitigators that are real, we can get through those real quickly. One is the relationship. The closer the relationship to the child, father or someone in power, a brother, a close uncle, someone that has, as the child's perspective is a closer relationship, the greater the trauma. The more distant the relationship, the less the trauma. And the greater there's likely, the more distant the relationship, the other thing that brings into mind is the greater likelihood that you're going to have a closer relationship who's going to be able to effectively intervene and protect the child when it comes to life. So it's a real key piece in terms of mitigating. Duration. How long did it go on? You know, was it 3 or 4 times? Was it a month? Was it 2 years? Was it 5 years? The longer that goes on, the longer the child experiences these things without intervention, the greater the trauma is going to be. Type of act. How explicit, as we go along this, how explicit did the act become? Did it only get to a point of fondling over the clothes? That's real different than fondling under the clothes. That's real different from invasion of personal body parts or of objects and those kinds of things that do happen. I don't like to talk about those things, but know that they're there. Know that the graphic part of sexual abuse does occur, and it's part of that sense of power, and it's part of that sense of the child lacking and being an object of experimentation. Force and injury. To what degree? Most children are compliant. And so if you can catch the offense at the point that they're still, it's only kind of rewards that they're getting, versus having, there's a time when in order to keep the offense going, the offender has to use their power. You don't have to use much power to be able to force a child to do certain things. So that force or injury, if there's physical injury that happens, it increases the trauma to the child. Parent reaction is a key. Probably it should be first, perhaps. That the sense of the parent or the non-offending parent, what their reaction is, and do they take clear steps to protect the child, to make it so the child clearly sees that they are not at fault, that things happen around them that protect them, and that they're not only told, but the actions around them affirm that they are valued. And then also the pre-abuse functioning. Where was the child at before the functioning, before the abuse happened? Did they have solid relationships? Were they making good progress on their development? A thing to remember that I think it gets hard to remember as we deal with the most severe issues of abuse is that abuse becomes, there's lots of kinds of child abuse, lots of traumas that children go through that are equal to sexual abuse in terms of trauma to the child. So sexual abuse doesn't stand out there and suddenly become this thing that if you're sexually abused, there's no hope of healing. It becomes for the child another thing they have to deal with. And maybe with sexual abuse, there's other issues that are going to be problems for them, and that supportive people around them need to be aware of that and help them with those things. But it becomes just another one for the children as they, in their lives, they move through their lives, and they look back and it becomes just another one of those things they think about. And another one of those things that they've had to overcome, like getting hit by their parents, or like having being hit by a car, or running into a fire hydrant with their bike and having to have surgery. There's lots of things that happen to children, traumas. Divorce can have a real, internal, real problem. It can be a real problem for children to deal with. So when you put it in that context, we have the ability, there is the ability to work through to healing from sexual abuse. And I think books like, I thank the bottom of my heart people like Judy who've been able to come out and portray that sense of healing. One last thing that I want to talk about is the connection of the church to sexual abuse. There's a book, and I got told by John last night that it did come in. It's called Challenging the Darkness, Child Sexual Abuse in the Church. It's not just focused on the church, because it also talks about what the issues are, and a lot of the statistics and things that I brought out in here are in this. It's a resource primarily. It's written as a resource for practical guide for Christian leaders and congregations to help the church be a more supportive part of the healing process for victims, and also the confrontation process for offenders. Church hasn't done well historically. Offenders have often been able to hide behind the church. And another thing is that a high percentage of offenders are church members. They use that hierarchical structure within some fundamentalist churches in particular well. They use it as a reason to maintain this kind of structure within the family. And they also use salvation and the concept of believing and being forgiven as a means of not having to deal with and effectively go through the hard work of therapy and change. They try to use it as a shortcut. And the church has not been good historically about forcing them to go through the reality of the hard work of the pain that they themselves have to go through to make true change. The concept of repentance is a turning around. It's not just saying it, but it's demonstrating it, and then through the process of demonstration being able to identify that yes, the repentance is full. a great quote from Marie Fortune, who is a pastor in Seattle who deals a lot with domestic violence issues. When asked by a pastor, well, what do you say to an offender who says, I see the light, I believe now in Jesus Christ, I've been living a life of sin and I now believe in Christ. What do you say to them? And she says, well, in my mind, what I say to them is, I'm really glad. I think that that's a necessary part of helping overcome, and it's going to be a great help in the next 8 years of intensive therapy. So somehow, you know, bridging that and affirming the fact that it's not instantaneous, and yet also affirming the fact that there is the Holy Spirit. And I believe with my whole heart, I couldn't have stayed in this field and not believe that the Holy Spirit does move in miraculous and instantaneous ways. But we have to protect our children. And we do know that sex offending is an addiction. And it's likened to alcohol addiction, in that people who are alcoholics are always alcoholics. They're just non-drinking alcoholics. Okay? Sex offenders, in a sense, are always sex offenders. They're always vulnerable to reoffending. And what you can build around them is a structure and a watchfulness to make sure that they don't have access to re-victimize. There's a whole lot that goes around that, but that's kind of in a nutshell. But I highly recommend this. I think he said there were only 5 copies that they got. But you can get information. If you, for some reason, don't get it, I can give you the address of it. And if it's something that you want, please look me up and I can get that for you. I highly recommend it if you're involved in a church, making sure it gets a part of your pastor's library, and that they read it, and that we talk about it, that we bring this issue up within our churches. It's a hard thing to deal with. It's a hard thing to ask about. But for our children's sake, we have to create ways of breaking that power cycle within our families that allow for sexual abuse to occur. Other questions or issues?
Is there any socioeconomic distribution?
Not in terms of the actual sexual offenses. There's some that skew it when you get into convictions, primarily because higher socioeconomic can afford the higher powered attorneys who basically get them off. So the legal system has a lot to do with that, as opposed. But most of the clinical research shows all cultures and all economic levels being pretty equal. That it has more to do with. Oh, one of the issues though that does happen is that the one piece of research shows that the children who've been sexually abused, as they grow older, earn less money than children who've not been sexually abused. And part of that has to do with the damage it's done, their inability to function as well in our society. So, yes?
What you're feeling about sort of the other side of the coin, that what chances there might be that a young child might say something that's really fantasy, not true, or with older children with these repressed memories are brought out and they turn out not to be true. Read articles in the paper these days about that.
Good question. And it's a lively topic in the research right now. I mean, it's being, I subscribe to a journal called the Journal of Interpersonal Violence, which is put out by Sage Publishing. And there's been a continuing dialogue, you know, back and forth between this.